Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If you enjoy the teachings from Beth Emmanuel, share the links with your friends. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends about the things you are learning at Beth Emmanuel. Help us grow the message.
So this is the 10th of Av, but we're actually honoring the 9th of Av today, because yesterday the 9th of Av fell on the Sabbath, as you know. So this is the fast of Av. It is the anniversary of the destruction of the temple. Twice, and it's the anniversary of the rejection of the land when the 10 spies gave the bad report. Two spies gave a good report, 10 spies gave a bad report. Now this class, our class here, is about, this class is about the fall festivals. And so it's not about the 9th of Av, necessarily. But there is a connection. And the connection is in Tractate Yoma of the Talmud that's behind us there, that connects the omens that came before the destruction of the temple during the Roman era, and the portents and signs leading up to that, with the festival of Yom Kippur. And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to learn that little piece of the Talmud, and then talk about how that fits in with Yom Kippur, and then we are going to turn our attention to other signs and omens that are reported regarding the destruction of the temple, because it should go without saying that God doesn't just destroy His own house willy-nilly. It says in the prophet Amos that it says that God doesn't do anything without alerting His servants, the prophets. And so we have a lot of that. We see a lot of that in our Bibles regarding the destruction of the temple the first time when the Babylonians were coming. I mean, you have the whole book of Jeremiah, for example, which is all prophecies predicting that this thing is going to happen and telling us exactly why. So we would expect to have something similar regarding the destruction of the temple during the days of the Roman era. And of course, we do. We do have something. And that is primarily the gospel. The gospel is the whole gospel message, and the mission of Yeshua of Nazareth was in anticipation of this terrible doom that was hanging over the generation. And the call to repent was trying to avert this coming doom. But in addition to that, there were other things going on that aren't recorded in the gospel, and we're going to look at some of that tonight. So this is kind of, will be an interesting slice of history for you to look at tonight. But first we should start with a little bit of talk about Yom Kippur so that you understand the context here of what we're talking about. I'm sure that most of you are already familiar, but a little review won't hurt anyway. We find the passage for Yom Kippur in our biblical calendar that we're studying in Leviticus 23. It starts in Leviticus 23 verse 7. I'll just buzz through that passage, and then we'll be going over to Leviticus 16, which gives us more of a close-up. So Leviticus 23, it starts in verse 27. It says, "Now on the 10th day of this 7th month is the day of atonement. It shall be a time of holy convocation, and you shall afflict yourselves and present a food offering to the Lord." All right, so when it says Day of Atonement, that is the Hebrew. Yom means day, and HaKippurim means the atonements. So in Hebrew, it's literally called the Day of the Atonements, but we shorten it down to Day of Atonement in translation. So what does atonement mean? Well, it's a broad word. It has a couple different applications, but it has the sense of, in one application, it has a sense of ransom, of paying a ransom for someone. In another application, it has a sense of covering, and this is a narrow, we only see this once, really, that I can think of. It's in the story of Noah and the Ark, when it says, you shall cover the ark with pitch. But I like that one because this is kind of the idea of what you need atonement for. You see, the whole concept of atonement is not necessarily sin. It's not necessarily a sin issue. It could be a sin issue, but there's other things. You see, here's the problem. When God said, I'm going to live in a tabernacle down there with you, in your midst, this created a problem because God is holy and he is completely other and transcendent. And so if things are going to survive in his presence, if things were to survive in his presence, they need to be covered in some sense. I consider it, like atonement, I consider it to be sort of the spiritual hazmat suit. For example, the altar, it says we have to atone for the altar. And you have to ask, well, did the altar sin or do some sin or something that it needs? So when we think of atonement as forgiveness for sins, we're missing the mark by quite a bit. That's not what atonement means. Now, forgiveness for sins may be a component of achieving atonement, but that's the two words are not, they're not interchangeable terms. All right? So we need to, here's the thing that we're going to find out when we get to Leviticus 16. If we're going to keep the tabernacle running and keep God's presence in the midst of the nation, we need a system of atoning for the tabernacle and actually for the nation. Because, if the nation isn't atoned for, how can God live in the midst of the nation? So that's what we're talking about here. When we say it will be a day of atonement. Okay. So it says, it shall be a time of a holy convocation, and you shall afflict yourselves and present a food offering to the Lord. Now, this afflict yourself sounds very general. It sounds like, well, let's see, what, it sounds like maybe you give up something for Lent. That's how you afflict yourself. Like, okay, on the Day of Atonement, I'm not going to eat any chocolate bars. That will be a big affliction. Or I won't get a Starbucks on the Day of Atonement. That will afflict me. Something like that. Or maybe you could just say, you know what? Today's the Day of Atonement. I'm going to strike myself on the head with a blunt object. Something like that. And that would afflict you. But instead, in Judaism, this term has a very specific meaning to afflict oneself. It means to deny oneself food and basic pleasures. And so there's actually a list. We'll study this in another time. There's a list of some specific things that you have to do to successfully afflict yourself. But I wanted to point out, I thought it's necessary to point out to people who are educated in the Gospels that our Master also teaches on fasting, doesn't he? He says, when you fast, don't be like the hypocrites who make their faces long in order to show everyone that they're fasting. I tell you the truth, they've received their reward in full. Rather, when you fast, you should wash your face and comb your hair and do some basic hygiene, brush your teeth or something, so that it won't be obvious to everyone that you're fasting. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Okay, so we all know that teaching, right? So you would think that that would apply to something like today, Tisha B'Av, or Yom Kippur. But if we read the halakha on these things, it says, no, you shouldn't wash on a fast day. And so you see, there seems to be a discrepancy with what the Master is teaching and what the rule of afflicting oneself on Yom Kippur is. But there's actually no discrepancy. Because our Master isn't talking about public fast days whatsoever. He wasn't speaking about Yom Kippur. He wasn't speaking about Tisha B'Av in that passage. I mean, and you can realize that if you just think about it logically. Everybody's fasting on those days. So how would it matter if somebody knew that you were fasting or not? In fact, to like try to make it look like you aren't fasting when everybody else is fasting would be to like have the appearance of sin. That would be to like pretend you're eating a pizza or something, on Yom Kippur. It doesn't make sense. But it makes total sense in regard to a private fast that you've undertaken yourself. When you undertake a private fast, it's nobody's business but God's. And that's the point of that teaching. Okay, so we're going to afflict ourselves on Yom Kippur. And it says, there's a very strong warning here. It says, whoever is not afflicted on that very day shall be cut off from his people, which is, what does it mean to be cut off from his people? Well, there's a couple different meanings. It could mean that you're excommunicated from the community of Israel, but that's what it means to be cut off by the hands of men. But then there's the rabbis speak of another form of being cut off, and that's being cut off by the hands of heaven. And that just means to die unexpectedly. Duh. All right. So for whoever is not afflicted shall be cut off from his people. Whoever does any work on that day, that person I will destroy from among his people. There you go. You shall not do any work. It is a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. No. There you go. Some other people that... It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest. Oh, I need one of those, Carrie.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict yourselves. On the ninth day of the month, beginning at evening, from evening to evening, you shall keep your Sabbath. So this is some serious talk, some put the fear of God in you type of stuff around Yom Kippur. And that's why it's the most solemn and austere day of all the festivals, for sure. And it's also considered the holiest day of the year. All right? Except that Sabbath is a little holier. But other than that, it's the holiest day of the year. It's the holiest festival of the year. And we'll find out why it's just so darn holy and when we go over to Leviticus chapter 16, which is what we're going to do right now. All right, so here we have this big long chapter. There's a lot of words in it, and I don't want to read them all. So I'm just going to tell you, but I want you to see where it is, so you can be confident that they're here. This is all here, okay? So it's here in Leviticus 16, and this is a description of the ceremony that takes place in the tabernacle and in the temple on the Day of Atonement, and so it starts out like this. The Lord says to Moses, tell Aaron, your brother, that he can't just come strolling into the Holy of Holies whenever he feels like. He can't be coming in here. If he does, he'll die. Because that's where I'm at. God is in the Holy of Holies. We don't really understand what that means or in what sense God could possibly be in the Holy of Holies. But he is. His Shekinah, his dwelling presence is there. So he says, you can't come in here whenever you want. So, case closed. Moses can go in, that's fine. Aaron can't, and the high priest can't. So that if that's all we needed to worry about, you could just end the chapter right there. It's like, okay, I won't go in. But there's a problem. The problem is that inside the Holy of Holies is an ark, right? The Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant needs to be atoned for because it's standing there in the presence of God. So somehow we have to atone for this thing. We have to do it annually. So here's what we do. We got to get into the Holy of Holies somehow and apply blood of a sin offering to atone for this Ark. Otherwise, we're going to lose the Ark. You know, or we're going to lose the divine presence of God, even worse. All right. So, here's what we have to do. We have to get our priest in a hazmat suit that can endure that kind of holiness and that kind of that extreme level of the divine. And so he's got to go through a lot of rituals. He's going to immerse himself five times or so on this day. He's going to take off all of his priestly garments. He's going to wear just simple white garments. And then there's going to be some sacrificial procedures that he's going to have to undergo. And he's going to confess all of his sins, the sins of his household, over a sin offering before he goes. And he's going to confess all the sins of the nation over a sin offering before he goes in. And so all these preparations, right? So the sin offerings are particularly interesting. He has a bull that he lays his hands on the head of this bull and he confesses all of his sins and the sins of his household, which it says, the sins of Aaron's household, it could be also understood as the sins of the whole priesthood for that matter. Then he sacrifices this bull as a sin offering and the blood is collected, right? And then there's two goats. They're identical goats. two identical goats that are brought before him. One of these goats is going to be a sin offering on behalf of the whole nation of Israel. The other goat is going to be for Azazel, whatever that means. And we'll study that more, what that means, Azazel, at another time. But it's sort of a sin offering. It's like an anti-sin offering in a sense. I don't really know how to explain it. But you take what you do with the Azazel goat, the scapegoat, we call it sometimes, is you take it and you put all the sins of the nation on it, all the uncleanness of the nation, and you just load it up on that goat, and then you send that goat out in the wilderness, and then you throw it over a cliff so it doesn't come back. That's how you deal with that. So you have these two goats, and they're identical goats, and you don't know which one is for the Lord and which one is for the sin offering. So the high priest takes two lots. You know what lots are? So one of them says for the Lord, for Hashem. The other says for Azazel. He puts the two lots in a hopper and he shakes them up. Right? Then he reaches his hands in there, both hands, grabs them, pulls them up, and checks and sees which one is in his right hand. And whichever, if it says for the Lord in his right hand, then the goat on his right hand side is going to be the sin offering. If it says for Azazel in his right hand, that's like considered a bad omen, because you want Hashem in your right, at your right hand, not Azazel. But if it says Azazel in your right hand, then the goat on your right side is going to be the one that gets thrown out in the wilderness as a sin offering. So once we've figured out which goat is the right goat, we'll sacrifice that goat, take its blood, and prepare its blood, and the priest takes incense. Then he goes into the Holy of Holies, and with this cloud, he goes in there and he lights this incense, and this incense fills the Holy of Holies with a cloud, because Hashem appears in the Holy of Holies. You can't look at God, right? So this, everything is obscured. It's totally dark in there too. And then he goes back out and he gets the blood of these goats and the bull, and he goes in and he sprinkles the blood on the Ark of the Covenant. And these ceremonies are taking place through, and it takes a while throughout the day. Meanwhile, while he's doing all of this, there's a designated man leading that goat out in the wilderness and there's stations set up along the way, because it's hot out there and it's dry and you're fasting, and you know a guy could collapse. So you pass this goat off to different people who are assigned to this task, and the last person takes him to the edge of a cliff and pushes him over the cliff. Now, it doesn't say that in our chapter, but that's how it was done. All right. Okay, so that is the ritual. And how do we know they pushed him over the cliff? Because it says so here. I've got the quote for you from the Mishnah in Yoma 6:6, where it says, "He pushed it over backward, and it rolled down the ravine. And it did not reach halfway down the mountain before it broke into pieces." So it's a very grisly way for this goat to die. But here's the thing, you didn't want this goat coming back, because it had all this, you laid your hands on it and loaded up all the sins of the nations on this goat. And the one thing that anyone who's ever had a goat knows about goats is that goats come back. And so if you're going to have this goat be a courier carrying all the sin of the nation away, you can't have the goat coming back. So what do you do? Throw it over a cliff. But there's other difficulties when you think about this. You have two identical goats. The high priest pulls up a lot, says, "This one's for the Lord." And then that one's designated for the Lord. But what if, I mean, the goats are supposed to be identical, and goats don't always stand in one place. And what if they get mixed up? What if you mix up the goats, and now one of them has been, what if you sacrifice the one that was designated for Azazel to the Lord? That would be a real problem, liturgically and ceremonially speaking. So, what we did was we devised a means by which to immediately designate these two goats, and so we could identify which was which. And so here's what it says in the Mishnah. It says, "He tied scarlet yarn on the head of the goat which was to be sent forth," into the wilderness, and turned it around, his back to the sanctuary, to face the way it would be sent out. So he turns this goat around so it's not facing Hashem anymore, and he ties scarlet yarn around its head. Okay. Now, the scarlet yarn is significant because we find that it's in all the other purification rituals that are similar, such as the cleansing of the leper and the ashes of the red heifer. So then he takes more scarlet yarn, and it says, on the one that was to be slaughtered for the sin offering, he tied the scarlet yarn around its neck. All right, so you can see what the difference is that the first goat, the one for Azazel, is going to die by having its head bashed. So we put the scarlet yarn around its head to symbolize that that's how it's going to, this is my theory, how it's going to die. Whereas the one that's going to be a sin offering is going to be slaughtered. It's going to be shacked. And so we put the scarlet yarn around its neck. That's my theory on why we do it that way. So, because it even says, he tied the scarlet yarn around its neck at the place at which the slaughter was to be made. Now, here's a very interesting thing about this. There's a tradition about this scarlet yarn that it would magically, if you can use the word magically in reference to a miracle of Hashem, it would magically turn from scarlet to white at the time that the goat was thrown down. So, Rabbi Ishmael said, and we find this in the Mishnah, it says, they tied a thread of scarlet wool over the gate. So you've got this, you know, you've got this same material that you're putting on the goats. It's the same batch. It's the same ball of yarn. All right? And they'd take the rest of this and they would put it over the gate of the temple. And when the goat reached the wilderness and was thrown down, the thread turned white. As it is written, though your sins are as scarlet, they will be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they will be like wool. So this was a big miracle, and everybody in the temple could see it. Everybody would come to participate in the services and ceremonies because they would hang that right up on the gate. And the people could see this miracle happen, right? So, here's another passage that backs this up. It says in the Talmud, our rabbis taught, at first they tied the scarlet yarn on the outside of the door to the temple entrance, and if the yarn turned white, the people saw it, and they rejoiced, because they understood it to mean that God has accepted the ceremonies, and atonement has been accomplished. All right? If the yarn turned white, the people saw it and rejoiced. But if it did not turn white, they felt sad and ashamed. You can understand. It's like, it would be a real downer at the end of your big Yom Kippur. It's like, oh, dang. So to prevent this feeling sad and ashamed, they begin to tie it to the inside of the door, to the temple entrance. But the people were still peeking in through the doorway to see if it became white. If it turned white, they rejoiced, but if it did not, they felt sad and ashamed. So to prevent this, they begin to tie the scarlet yarn to the rock in the wilderness where the goat was pushed over the edge. All right, and so this is, they had a problem with the scarlet yarn, you know, because sometimes it would turn white, sometimes it wouldn't. But here's the interesting thing about this. 40 years before the destruction of the temple. Now, if we date the destruction of the temple at 70 Common Era, that's when it happened, in the year 70 AD, if you prefer. 40 years before that is 30 AD, which is the year that we believe the Master suffered and rose and ascended. So, We're just doing the math backwards by the Talmud. Now remember that the writers of the Talmud are not believers, and they're not cross-checking their facts against the Gospels or anything. They're just reporting traditions from the Jewish community. And so the tradition is that 40 years for 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the lot for the Lord on Yom Kippur, when he would throw those in the hopper and shake them up, the lot did not come up in the right hand. Instead, it came up in the left hand. So this is to say that in the year that the master died, beginning that year, and for the next 40 subsequent years, which defies the probability, right?
Extremely. 2 to the 40th power. 1 in 2 to the 40th power chances that it would be that every single time. Flipping a coin.
Yeah, it's like you try to flip a coin 40 times and always come up heads. All 40 times. Yeah. So it defies probability, but the lot for Azazel came up in the right hand for these 40 years. Moreover, the strip of red cloth did not turn white. So for 40 years, they never had that miracle again, of that strip of red cloth turning white. Moreover, the western light of the menorah did not stay lit. So you know how the menorah has 7 lamps across, all right? So during the days of Simon the Righteous, who was a high priest from about the time of Alexander the Great, the tradition was that for 40 years, this western light of the menorah would not go out. When all the rest would burn out their oil, this one would always still have a little flame burning on it. And so, you know, that was an auspicious thing, that the lamp never went out. But now we have the reversal of that miracle. Beginning in the year that the master died, this one lamp that was sort of the Ner Tamid, the eternal lamp of the temple, kept going out, which would have been very frustrating. I noticed that one of our lights was out in Shachrit yesterday. I think it was the westernmost one. Yep. They're all westernmost, aren't they? So here's another one. 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the doors of the temple would not stay closed, but they opened up by themselves. And this is an amazing, amazing thing. The doors opened up by themselves. Because these are not small doors. These are really, really big doors. Like two-story, three-story doors. Extremely heavy doors. And they would open up by themselves. And it was really spooky. And so finally, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai rebuked them. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, how did he rebuke them? He went up to the doors and he said, "Temple, temple, for what purpose do you frighten with your counsel? I know about you. Your future ending will be destruction. For Zechariah ben Iddo has already prophesied about you in Zechariah 11:1, where it says, 'Open your doors, O Lebanon, so that fire may devour your cedars.'" So it's an interesting piece of exegesis, and we see him use it more than once, this idea that Lebanon doesn't refer to the country of Lebanon. Rather, Lebanon is a secret prophetic code word for the temple, because Solomon built the temple and paneled it with cedars of Lebanon. So Yochanan ben Zakkai saw this. He said, "Now what can that mean? Open, the doors are opening. What could that possibly mean?" So he's going through the scriptures in his head, you know, flipping through the scriptures, and he's like, "Is there anything about the temple doors opening in any of the prophets?" And then it hits him. Wait a second. Doesn't it say somewhere, "Open your doors, O Lebanon"? That could be, "Open your doors, O temple." And then what does it say after that? It says, "So that fire may devour your cedars." So he saw the opening of the temple doors to be a prophetic sign of the coming destruction of the temple. It's very interesting that this began happening in the year that our master suffered and died. Yes. So, good. That's the tradition on this piece regarding the information from Jewish lore.
Isn't the tearing of the veil really kind of in the same genre?
Yes. Yeah, so yeah, the tearing of the veil also happens in that year. And it has the same significance. It has the same kind of significance. You know, the tearing of the veil is an important... I keep meaning to do a sermon on that, and I keep forgetting. Because it's something you just need to do from time to time, because it's like... It's one of those things that's firmly rooted in Christian theology, that the tearing of the veil represents the end of the old covenant and the cancellation of the temple system. Well, no, it doesn't. That's not what it means at all. But it falls into the same category as a sign, a portent of this coming destruction. Yes.
Extra-biblical reference to the curtain tearing?
No, there's not an extra-biblical reference to the curtain tearing, which isn't really surprising, except in one bogus version of Josephus there is, but which was interpolated by Christian scribes. But there is a reference to the curtain in the Talmud when Titus, the conqueror, enters the temple. He takes his sword and stabs it through. And according to the legend, it bled. The curtain bled when he stabbed it. So then it says Titus was foolish enough to think that he had killed God. So that might be sort of a conflated, confused memory of the tearing of the veil that's been, you know, as it came through the cycle of Jewish tradition and that sort of thing. Got bound up with this story about Titus. It's possible. It's possible. The tearing of the veil is, people often think that veil then would have been hanging there torn for a long time, but I don't think you would have even made it to the end of the day before there was a new veil up. They had spares of everything, absolutely everything. There is a tradition that's recorded in the Gospel according to the Hebrews that a massive lintel stone, cracked on that day as well. A massive stone in the temple.
And there's archaeological evidence of earthquake. There's seismological evidence.
Sure. Earthquakes and that sort of thing in that area. Okay, so you don't have a corroborating source, though, for the tearing of the veil. But here's what's very interesting. This is what we're going to look at now. We have a corroborating source for the opening of the temple doors. And it's from a secular source. Now, of course, Josephus isn't really secular. He's a Pharisee. But he's writing for a secular readership. And so he's following a Greek style of writing, and so you could call it a secular source. But that's just one of many things that he's going to report as omens of the temple's destruction. And so we're going to work through this passage of Josephus together now, and I'll give you a little bit of commentary on each of these things as we go. All right. So he says, to begin with, in that year, there was the year that, what year? Not the year the temple was destroyed, but in the year that the Jewish war began, the revolt began. So we're talking about the year 66. In fact, we'll have to go back a little bit into the year 65 for the beginning of this. 65 AD, say, and 66 AD. He says, thus there was a star resembling a sword which stood over the city. What would that be? A star resembling a sword that stood over the city. And a comet that continued a whole year. All right, well, this is very interesting because we can figure that out. And, in fact, Halley's Comet was visible from Jerusalem in the year 66 Common Era. So he's talking about Halley's Comet, except for one problem. Halley's Comet doesn't last a year. And so what scholars have done in looking at this passage, if you look closely, he speaks of two different phenomenons. One is a star that hung over the city, and one is a comet. And if you look into Chinese records, the Chinese were keeping records of astronomical phenomenon all the way back, they reported in late 65 a comet, and then another comet, which would have been Halley's, in 66. So it accords with this, that and these things would have been visible in the Jerusalem sky. You would have seen these stars. Amazing, amazing things. So you can picture like the tail of the comet kind of doing a swoop, you know, and that would look like a scimitar. So he says it hung over the city like a sword. That's speaking of the tail of the comet. Thus, also, before the Jews' rebellion and before those commotions which preceded the war, when the people were coming great crowds to the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So now it's Passover. And this is Passover in the year 66. On the eighth day of the month of Nisan. So we're not to Passover yet. Okay. At the ninth hour of the night. So what is that? About 3 a.m. So great a light shone around the altar and the holy house that it appeared to be bright daytime, which lasted for half an hour. This light seemed to be a good sign to the unskillful. In other words, to the common people. The common people said, well, light from heaven, that's got to be a good sign. That's got to be a good sign. But was so interpreted by the sacred scribes as to portend those events that followed immediately upon it. When he says the sacred scribes, there's very little doubt in my mind that he's referring to Yochanan ben Zakkai and his colleagues. As we saw, Yochanan ben Zakkai interpreted the doors, what was happening with the doors. So we find passages in the scripture. You can find passages like Isaiah 66, is it, where it talks about, you know, rise up, let your light shine, you know, on Zion and this sort of thing. And this is like the common people say, oh, this is a good sign. You know, we should this God is going to be with us in the rebellion. This is a sign of the messianic era. The light is shining. And Yochanan ben Zakkai looks at it and says, I think there's another passage where it says it shall be a strange day that's neither day nor night, you know, a light, so he takes a passage from Zechariah about impending doom. Okay, so at the same festival also, a heifer was, as she was led forth by the high priest to be sacrificed, brought forth a lamb in the midst of the temple. Now this is not a good sign. I know that you think this is impossible, but it's certainly not. I mean, what it really means is that this cow dropped. She gave birth to a calf with severe mutations. That happens all the time. You can go to when I was a kid, you would go to the circus or something like that, and they would have these like mutated animals, you know, these that had come by means of mutation, stuffed for people to look at. It was always interesting, two-headed things and whatnot. So all it really means is that she gave birth to a calf that looked more like a lamb than a cow. Now, here's the thing. It's surprising just that she gave birth to a calf. Because the priesthood are pretty good with livestock. And if there was a pregnant cow, they would know, we're not going to sacrifice this one. It's a pregnant cow. You know?
It's that pregnant that it's ready to deliver.
Right. Right. So disturbing. And nobody came in and said, well, I think this is a good sign. All right. Moreover, the eastern gate of the inner court of the temple, which was of brass and extremely heavy, had been built with difficulty, shut by 20 men and fastened with iron-bound bars. These are the Nicanor gates. and had bolts sunk very deep into the firm floor, which was there made of one entire stone for the threshold, was seen to be opened of its own accord about the sixth hour of the night. So at about midnight during Passover is when they're recording this. Now those who kept watch in the temple came hereupon running to the captain of the temple and told him of it, and then came up there, and not without great difficulty was able to shut the gate again. This also appeared to the common people to be a very happy prodigy. They said, oh, doesn't it say, open the gates of righteousness, or, you know, or something like that. As if God thereby opened to them the gate of happiness. But the men of learning understood it. Yochanan ben Zakkai, he understood it based on that Lebanon prophecy. That the security of their holy house was dissolved of its own accord, and that the gate was opened for the advantage of their enemies. Now what you have here is an incredible moment when you have a corroborating source from the first century. Josephus lived through these times. He's not just telling, you know, like, he knew, he was there, you know. Actually, he was in Rome at this very moment. But, you know, he was there within a few months after the event. He's what you call a primary source. So the tradition in the Mishnah that we read about the same thing happening is written down about two centuries later, as far as we know, at least in the version that we have of it. All right. So you might think, well, you can't trust something that was written two centuries later. You know, the rabbis are always making up goofy stuff. Anyway, but here you have a first century voice confirming it in remarkable, remarkable detail. I think that's great. And it's a treat. It doesn't happen very often that you get that. So these sages publicly declared that the signal predicted the desolation that was coming upon them. And so Yochanan ben Zakkai and his group, the sages that are with him, are going to be part of sort of an anti-war party. They see where this thing is going. And they're not the only ones that would have been like part of this anti-war party who see where this thing is going to end up. The believers also are in Jerusalem at this time. Yes, and they also know where this thing is going to end up because the Master has already told them where it's going to end up. And so they're not real keen on a war with Rome either. In fact, you'll remember that Yeshua had told them to watch for a couple signs. One sign that they would know for sure get out of town is if they saw the abomination of desolation standing in the temple. Well, yeah, by then it's a little late. Okay, so another sign he gave them was that if they saw the city surrounded by armies, they should get out of town and head for the hills, right? Even then it's a little late. You know, once the city is surrounded by armies, it's pretty hard to flee. You know? So even then it's a little late. So the way that it actually ended up, and we learned this from Eusebius, the church historian, and he transmits the tradition in the name of Hegesippus, I believe, who was a Jewish believer. The way it actually ended up was that there was a revelation vouchsafed to certain men that the time had come that they should flee the city and go across the Jordan River to a city called Pella, a Decapolis city, which was a Gentile city, where they could take refuge through the war. And we're talking about the apostolic community in Jerusalem that was, at this time, headed up by Simon, son of Clopas, who was the cousin of the Master and the second bishop over Jerusalem after James. I use the word bishop with some hesitation because when you think of a bishop, you think of a hat, a certain style of hat, you know, but bishop just means an overseer. All right. So, now remember these signs that we're watching for. Besides these, a few days after that feast, on the 21st day of the month of Iyar, And by this time, tensions have really reached a boiling point with Rome in a bad way, and there's been some bloodshed already. A certain prodigious and incredible phenomenon appeared. I suppose the account of it would seem to be a fable if it were not related by those who saw it, and were not the events that followed it of so considerable nature as to deserve such signals. For before sun setting, chariots and troops of soldiers in armor were seen running about among the clouds and surrounding the cities. So this is a bizarre thing. The idea is that it's the counting of the Omer. We're in the counting of the Omer. We're coming up halfway. We're about halfway to Pentecost now. And it's around sunset. And you look out over the walls around sunset. And suddenly you say, you know, it looked like something moving up there in the clouds. And as you're looking, it's like, it looks like armies. It looks like chariots. It looks like soldiers on the move. And they're surrounding, it looks like they're surrounding the city. Now remember what the master had said. When you see Jerusalem compassed about by armies, you know that the time is near.
What year is that?
This is all in 66.
Oh. This is sort of a typo.
Does ER 21 mean?
21st of ER, 66.
Yeah, ER 21, oh, it's missing okay. The 66. Yeah. Okay, so a couple weeks later, it's the festival of Shavuot, Pentecost, all right? And we read this, it says, "Moreover, at that feast which we call Pentecost, as the priests were going by night into the inner court of the temple, as their custom was, to perform their sacred ministrations." Okay, so what this means is, it's like, it's actually before dawn. Every day before dawn, the priests that were going to be serving that day, they would get up and, taking torches, they would go out into the temple courtyards, and they would circle about the altar. One group would circle this way, another group would circle this way. They'd check everything, make sure everything's in place, everything's okay, and then the two processions would meet up, and they'd say, everything is okay, everything is in order. And then the day's sacrifices could start right as the sun came up after that. So they're going out to do that. They've got their torches. And they said that in the first place they felt a quaking and they heard a great noise. Now this should remind us of Shavuot in 30 Common Era. Shavuot in the year that the Master died and rose. There was a quaking and a great noise in the temple. At Shavuot, the day of Pentecost. And after that they heard a sound as of a great multitude saying, "We are departing from here." Or actually it's in another version or translation of the Greek, it says, "Let us depart from here." Let us depart from here. Alright, so it's my contention that this is the revelation that Eusebius referred to, that Hegesippus referred to, that was the signal for the Jewish believers when they pulled out of town. This is just a couple weeks before the war really begins at Sukkot. So this is the last big appointed time before the war begins. But so we have a revelation that comes to the believers that says it's time to depart. And here you have a revelation on Shavuot, which and it even involves some of the same signs as the last big revelation that they received on a Shavuot. And there's a voice that says, "Time to go. Let us depart from here." But what is still more terrible, there was one Jesus, the son of Ananus. So this would be a guy named Yeshua Bar Hanan. And so, you know, Yeshua is Jesus. Jesus was one of the most common names of the first century. It's in the top 10 of boys' names for first century Jewish boys in the land of Israel. So there was one guy named Jesus, the son of Hanan, a common man and a husbandman, So he's a farmer. He's just a simple farmer who 4 years before the war began, and at a time when the city was in very great peace and prosperity, came to that feast whereon it is our custom for everyone to make tabernacles to God in the temple. So Josephus says, you know, it's Sukkot. It's Sukkot 4 years before, the war began. Well, the war begins in 66. It begins at Sukkot of 66. So 4 years before that would be 62, Sukkot of 62. This is a really interesting date, Sukkot of 62, because James, the brother of the master, who up to that time had been in the temple praying to avert the disaster every day, so much so that they called him Camel Knees because he was always on his knees praying for the city. That is the year he died. He died, he was thrown down from the parapet of the temple at Passover of the year 62. And so at the very next festival, Sukkot, would be about the time that Simon, son of Clopas, is appointed to replace him. But at that time, this prophet shows up from nowhere. And this farmer named Yeshua ben Hanan. And he just shows up at Sukkot, and he begins to just shout, he begins to cry, a voice from the east, a voice from the west, a voice from the four winds, a voice against Jerusalem and the holy house, a voice against the bridegroom and the bride, and a voice against this whole people. And this was his cry as he went about by day and by night in all the lanes of the city. So he does this all through the festival of Sukkot. It's driving everybody crazy. However, certain of the most eminent among the populace had great indignation at this dire cry of his. So when Josephus uses the words, certain of the most eminent of the populace, he means the Sadducees.
It's a long name.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times he'll just say the Sadducees. But that's going to be the rich aristocracy. Okay? So, they took up the man and gave him a great number of severe stripes. So they can do this. They can, I mean, that's within their purview. They arrest him. They say, okay, you know what? We're going to flog you. So they can give him 39 floggings, you know, and tell him to quit going around saying these gloomy things. Yet he did not either say anything for himself or anything peculiar to those who chastised him, but still went on with the same words which he cried before. So the flogging didn't work. Hereupon our rulers, supposing as the case proved to be that this was a sort of divine fury in the man, brought him to the Roman procurator, where he was whipped till his bones were laid bare. Now, the Roman procurator at this time is a man named Albinus. And now, so this is not a Jewish flogging. This is a scourging, a Roman scourging. The difference is profound. So the Romans used a leather whip with bone chunks and glass chunks and stones knotted into the leather in order to lacerate the flesh. And they don't have to stop at 39. So this is what our master went through, another Jesus, 32 years earlier. So where he was whipped till his bones were laid bare, yet he did not make any supplication for himself nor shed any tears, but turning his voice to the most lamentable tone possible at every stroke of the whip, his answer was, woe, woe to Jerusalem. And when Albinus, for he was then our procurator, asked him who he was and from where he came and why he uttered such words, he made no manner of reply to what he said, but still did not stop his melancholy dirge, till Albinus took him to be a madman and dismissed him. All right, so this was 62. Now, during all the time that passed before the war began, so from 62 to 66, we're talking for 4 years, this man did not go near any one of the citizens, nor was seen by them Well, he said so, but he every day uttered these lamentable words as if it were his premeditated vow, woe, woe to Jerusalem. So he goes around, he doesn't leave after Sukkot. He just keeps wandering the city streets pronouncing this dirge. Nor did he give ill words to any of those who beat him every day, nor good words to those who gave him food. But this was his reply to all men, and indeed no other than a melancholy presage of what was to come. This cry was the loudest at the festivals, you know, in the pilgrimage festivals when the city would fill up with people. And he continued this dirge for 7 years and 5 months without growing hoarse or being tired therewith, until the very time that he saw his presage in earnest fulfilled in our siege, when it ceased. For as he was going around upon the wall, so he's walking the wall line of Jerusalem. You know, you can do that. You know, you can walk along the walls. But this is during the Roman siege now, when the Romans have already drawn up their lines. It's we're up to the year we're up to the year 70 now at this point, and the 10th Legion has started the bombardment with catapults. And they use these enormous catapult stones, like the size of one of these tables, blocks of limestone. They would load up in these catapults. And they'd send these things out, just, you know, and they would just, when they would hit, boom, just the blow of it would kill everybody in the immediate vicinity. So they're sending these things over, and there were these huge things of white limestone. So the watchmen on the walls would watch for them coming. And then when they would see one in the air, they would say, the sun is coming. You know, the sun is coming. I don't know why they called it the sun. Not like S-U-N, but the sun. This coming of the Son of Man or something, you know. So the Romans realized, oh, they can see them because they're white. They're easy to see against the sky. So they started blackening them before they would load them up so that they wouldn't be able to pick them out of the sky so easily. So these things would come in at tremendous speed. And so this Yeshua ben Hanan is walking the wall, and he's doing his lament. He says, woe, woe to the city again, and to the people, and to the holy house. And just as he added at the last, woe, woe to myself also, there came a stone out of one of the engines and smote him and killed him immediately. And as he was uttering the very same presages, he gave up the ghost. And so that's the story of Yeshua ben Hanan. A remarkable story in many ways, and with some remarkable parallels to the gospel story of our master, who's also called Yeshua, who's also a prophet, who also predicts the coming destruction of the temple, who also pronounces woe over Jerusalem, who's also arrested by the Sadducees, who's also turned by the Sadducees over to the Romans, who's also flogged, and so forth. So really interesting parallel. But those are the omens. That's the list of the omens from Josephus and from the Talmud. There might be more that I'm not aware of, but these are the ones that I know about.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy these teachings, please share them with your friends and family, and consider supporting us by clicking the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.